On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We went with the two-actor approach and then pushed it even further by not having Paul and John coordinate the performances. It was pushing the envelope, and it was risky, but it would have paid off if it worked.
Love and Mercy director Bill Pohlad's plan to have Paul Dano and John Cusack both play the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson at different times in his life did work. His uniquely structured biopic is one of the few summer releases now in the Oscar race. Pohlad has produced and helped finance a slate of award-winning films, including Brokeback Mountain and 12 Years a Slave. He tells us how he decides which films to back and why Love and Mercy was the movie that brought him back to directing after a 24-year hiatus. But first on the news banter is ailing 92-year-old mogul Sumner Redstone, competent to run CBS and Viacom? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, Viacom, once again, Viacom and CBS, huge media empire, the creation of Sumner Redstone, who is now 92 years old, frail and ailing. There has been a long brewing battle over who's going to control this company when Sumner Redstone finally passes away. And this has become drastically accelerated in recent weeks. Sumner Redstone's longtime girlfriend and then close friend, Manuela Hertzer, was booted out of his house and has subsequently gone to court. And she had a lot of control. People sometimes speculated as to how much control, but definitely quite a lot of control where Sumner Redstone's affairs were concerned. She's believed to have benefited to the tune of many, many millions of dollars. And she has responded to being dismissed from the house by going to court and saying that he is not competent at this point in his life. He is not competent, an important issue for the head of two major media companies, CBS and Viacom, and that she needs to be reinstated to take care of him.
Yeah, and not only does she say that in her lawsuit, but she paints a very, very damaging picture of Sumner Redstone. She says that he is incoherent at times, he's crying, he's been distraught because he hasn't been able to have daily sex and steak. According to the documents, she has included photos of him that are very unflattering. I mean, it's just all of it is just awful for Viacom. But the question is Sumner Redstone mentally competent? And if not, what is the Viacom board and the Viacom shareholders going to do about it?
Now, the guy who's actually running Viacom on a day-to-day basis, Philippe Domon, and who would appear to have quite a big stake in Sumner Redstone staying where he is and being deemed competent.
This is the same Philippe Domon who made $44 million as the CEO of Viacom this past year. So there is an incentive for him to keep the status quo as it is.
Yes, exactly. But at the same time, one of the major shareholders in Viacom, Mario Gabelli, has come out and said, well, wait a minute, why is Philippe Domon, why is he now allowed to be, as apparently he is, in charge of Sumner Redstone's health affairs and allowed to be the spokesperson as to whether this person is competent or not? You know, you have a duty to shareholders when you have a company like this. You know, there's not supposed to be a situation where there's a conflict like that, and possibly Sumner Redstone is not competent. The shareholders should know that.
The more interesting question here is, ultimately, the control of the company is going to pass to a trust. When Sumner Redstone either dies or is determined to be incompetent, the trust will take control. And the trust is controlled by several people, one of whom is Sumner Redstone's daughter, Sherry. There are several lawyers with ties to the family and his ex-wife on it. Philippe Domon is one of the trustees as well. And ultimately, the trust is going to be the thing that controls the ultimate disposition of this company.
Yeah, so there's a big power battle going on, and undoubtedly there's going to be still more litigation, whether or not Manuela Hertzer can get a court to decide whether Sumner Redstone is mentally competent, which the court for now postponed for a while, saying that there was no urgent need to make this determination, which is, you know, considering that the man is extremely frail, I don't know. But, you know, I don't think in a way, what if he passes away or not, there will still be this fight.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, I don't think Manuela Herzer can do anything about the trust. She is in this either, if you believe her, to vindicate Sumner Redstone's rights and what he would want for a caretaker, or if you believe Viacom, she's in this for purely personal benefit reasons and wants to continue to get money from this guy who has given her millions over the years. But regardless of her motives, she has no control over the trust. The trust will take control of this company, and then is when we're going to really see the impact on CBS
right.
and Viacom.
Whether it's sold, what happens to it, or parts of it are sold, we'll see. Now, turning to a different type of woman, I guess I'm going to say, a group of women and others, not just women, met recently in Hollywood, 44 entertainment leaders, to talk about gender inequality. And this is, we've talked about it before, it's topic A in some ways in Hollywood right now, because the moment just seems to have arrived. You know, the statistics haven't improved year over year for a long, long time. Women are drastically underrepresented in front of and behind the camera. So this group met and they came up with some ideas, but, you know, it's a very difficult problem to get your arms around.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the ideas that were put forth at this meeting apparently were that films would get a seal of approval, that they had been vetted for gender parity. Another idea was that specific procedures be put in place to make sure that women were being interviewed for these types of jobs. I think these are all steps in the right direction. The question is, how much of this can be implemented in what is essentially a subjective and creative industry?
Yeah, and I think it's a tough thing. I mean, this gender parity stamp idea would be given not just to films, but TV shows, production companies, networks, and studios that are making progress in gender parity. You know, there's supposed to be an EEOC, an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigation, but it's very difficult. There's not one big employer. It's not like they can say, well, this is the Firestone Tire Company, and we're going to go after you. Hollywood is, you know, and it's not just the studios even. There are production companies and sub-production companies on projects. But, you know, people are talking about it. And the thing I do note about this meeting that I don't know why it happened, but it did happen. There are really not any executives represented. There's a list that includes a bunch of agents, people who are important in the business, people like Jenji Cohen, who is, you know, created Orange is the New Black and is hardly the problem here. People like Mike DeLuca, who produced 50 Shades of Grey, among other things, but is also a veteran executive and has had a lot of experience in the business. But the people who are in really controlling the switches at the studio, I don't know if they were invited and didn't go, but not really represented here.
I mean, yeah, there's been a lot of attention to that. Arguably the two most powerful women in the film business, Donna Langley, who's the chairman of Universal Pictures, and Stacey Snyder, who's the co-chairman at 20th Century Fox, were not there. But who knows? They may have had a conflict. I don't want to blame anyone for not attending this.
Yeah, well, neither were the guys who run this, you know, neither were the Jim Giannopoulos's or, you know, not to call him out specifically, but almost no executives represented at this.
To me, this is a start. This is a conversation. This has been the topic A of the year ever since the Sony hack revealed these gender discrepancies in pay. And I think that you are going to eventually see some kind of industry-wide movement towards gender parity. The question is, how much will be mandated, how much will be even able to be mandated, and how much the government is going to get involved in this.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, piss on you, banana. I like it.
That's Paul Dano as musician Brian Wilson in the film Love and Mercy, working on an early version of one of the Beach Boys' biggest hits. Dano plays the 1960s Pet Sounds era Brian Wilson, while John Cusack plays Wilson in the 1980s, during a time when abusive therapist Eugene Landy controlled almost every aspect of his life. The person who helped Wilson break free was Melinda Ledbetter, played in the film by Elizabeth Banks. Love and Mercy depicts Wilson's first meeting with Ledbetter at a Cadillac dealership. Landy, played by Paul Giamatti, soon interrupts.
Do you know who this man is? Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Ah. You didn't mention that.
Well, because that stuff doesn't matter. That's ego stuff, you know?
Are you kidding me? I love your music. I grew up on it. So thank you.
That makes me feel really good, Melinda Ledbetter.
The director of Love and Mercy and our guest today is Bill Pohlad, who spent the past decade primarily as a producer. He's got a nose for award winners, including Brokeback Mountain, Into the Wild, The Tree of Life, and 12 Years a Slave. Bill Pohlad is the son of Carl Pohlad, who became a banking billionaire and owned the Minnesota Twins baseball team until his death in 2009. Bill Pohlad is still on the team's board, but he didn't go into the family business. Instead, he fell in love with film at an early age, and of course, what he really wanted to do was direct. His first attempt, Old Explorers, was a bomb. It took 24 years for Pohlad to try again with Love and Mercy. We reached him in his hometown of Minneapolis, where he told us that he intends to stay despite his involvement in entertainment.
You know, it's easy to get caught up in certain ideas and mindsets in L.A. I mean, certainly it's kind of an industry city, and there's a lot of incestuous, you know, conversations and ideas going on there. And then when you, at least for me, when I come back to Minneapolis, almost the minute I land, it feels different, and you might look at ideas differently and go, oh, that wasn't such a good idea. What was I thinking?
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing.
Do you feel that you get caught up in sort of this competitive, anxious? I mean, to me, what sort of flows through the environment in the industry is anxiety.
Yeah, there is a fair amount of that, indeed. I mean, I never approach it from a competitive standpoint. Honestly, I'm just not that way, I think. You know, whether it's an idea or a partnership with different people, it feels like it needs to be right for everybody and it can't be forced. If it's a competitive situation, if it works out, great. If it doesn't, then there's a reason.
Now, you grew up as a very wealthy person.
Well, not entirely.
No?
More recently, certainly when I was a kid, my father wasn't as successful at that point, and it just grew as I grew up.
And that's interesting. So you witnessed your father transforming into a billionaire.
Exactly.
Sort of in a nutshell, what's that like? I mean, does your life just change so dramatically as that happens?
No. Not at all. I mean, he was a very, and both my parents, very kind of modest and humble people. So that's what I mean. The way we grew up didn't really change that much through all that success. I think that's part of the Minneapolis thing or the Midwest thing or whatever. It just doesn't get to be as big as it seems to be in other places or in other situations.
So you opened your company, River Road, in 1987. And I read a quote that you said somewhere, which was, I didn't want to walk away after a couple of years feeling like I had attended some great parties and lost a bunch of money. And that is, generally speaking, when someone with wealth comes into this industry, as you undoubtedly know, that's often the objective of the studios or anybody who hopes to make a film, is to take the person to a bunch of parties and then have them lose a bunch of money.
Yeah. No, I mean, certainly growing up, my father had a fair amount of exposure to, you know, film people coming through and looking for those kinds of things. And he was always very smart about it. Often they would come by and ask him for advice and things, but he would never get involved. He was just very skeptical of the business. So my interest in the business came purely from wanting to make films.
Okay, so the first one was this Old Explorers. Was that
exactly
the first one?
Yeah, we did that in 89, 90.
You did not get a great review for that. It was the TV Guide said verbose and snail paced. That's got, I'm sure you don't want to be reminded of that, but.
No, I mean, that's all part of life.
Yes, that's part of life.
I mean, you know, certainly it didn't work out the way we wanted. We got distribution, but, you know, financially it was, and creatively, I suppose, was not a success, which is why I didn't jump right back into another one. I didn't think going out and raising money from family and friends to do that again was responsible. So I ended up doing these documentary and commercial things to find my way another way.
So you said, okay, let me just take a pause here. And you start producing, and it doesn't sound like overnight success, but certainly you hit a tremendous run of success.
Yeah, I mean, once I made the decision to come out and kind of focus on producing, the first film we committed to in our deal with Focus was Brokeback Mountain. So it worked out pretty well right off the bat. Not that, you know, everything's been a success since then, but it was nice to get started with that success.
And then you go on, I mean, you had Brokeback Mountain, Into the Wild, Tree of Life, 12 Years a Slave. Do you have a sort of a lens through which you evaluate material? Is it a gut thing?
Yeah, it's just a gut thing. I figured if I was going to have one chance to do it, I wanted to do films that I believed in as opposed to trying to figure out, you know, what was going to be the next big thing or try to work the numbers or something like that. And that's how Brokeback Mountain came. It was really just a pure belief in that script. Certainly, we had no idea at the time that it was going to do what it did. In fact, you know, at that time, nobody was cast. Ang Lee was just kind of circling it at that point. So it was really truly a belief in the script and the material.
Of course, you've been in this at a time when the studios have shuttered. You know, Focus is no longer really Focus at Universal. Paramount closed its specialty arm. The pressure has been great. I mean, you have found studio partners on many of these films. Has it become increasingly difficult? It's a space, as we've talked about often on this show, that's, you know, that kind of adult films largely abandoned by the studios.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that they're risky. I mean, it's certainly easier or, I mean, easy probably isn't the right word, but a little less risky to go, you know, with franchises and things like that, things with formulas that seem like you can justify to your shareholders or whatever that this is why we made this decision versus, you know, more serious drama where it's harder to predict or prove, you know, what's going to happen with them.
I just wrote an article about this in The Hollywood Reporter. There is a group of people who come in and there's they have the money and the backing either from one way or another. And they start dabbling in movies and maybe drinking their own Kool-Aid. And I assume you just don't see yourself as that ilk at all, and you don't appear to be of that ilk.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's for others to judge. That's not what my motivation is. Clearly, you know, I think Love and Mercy is hopefully gives an indication that there's something else going on here.
Yes, what would you say it is for you?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously I was lucky enough to be in a position that we could provide some financing to some of our projects, which then gave me a foot in the door. But the intention all along has been to, you know, my interest is more in filmmaking rather than finance or the business side of it. So I used it as an entree, but hopefully we've been able to prove the worth of it beyond that.
So a producer, somebody brought you this project as a possible finance partner, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was called Heroes and Villains in the first iteration.
So John Wells, they were trying to get the movie made, and they came to River Road in hopes that we would partner on it.
And you didn't care for the script?
No. I mean, you know, whatever. It's a good script, but it didn't do anything for me, and it didn't seem
a little oxymoronic. A good script that did nothing for me.
Well, but it's true. I mean, I often tell the story of, like, Sideways, you know, was a film that early on we could have done, and I chose not to because it didn't really connect with me. It's not something I want to go with.
Right.
And I think that's important, that you go with your heart, or at least the way I like to do things, you go with the heart and what you believe in. So that's how I saw Heroes and Villains. But I was interested in the subject matter. So I said, look, if this doesn't work out for you guys, you know, come back and we'll start over.
So they go out, Heroes and Villains does not gel, and they circle back.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, this script needs to change because I'm not feeling it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I had kind of an idea of how to approach it. You know, it certainly wasn't my interest to do a biopic and kind of the traditional soup to nuts biography. I wanted to do something more intimate. So I, you know, had that kind of idea and started to develop it as we were starting to look at talking to writers. And then eventually I met Oren Moverman, who, you know, we connected immediately on it. And so we started working on it with me as a producer and him as the writer. In fact, he was kind of on our list, so to speak, of directors for the film. But as we worked more and more on it, he was the one who said to me, you know, you should really do this. You've got a clear vision of it, and you're rolling with it, and you should do it. And so it was a good excuse to say, okay, and jump back in.
Coming up after a short break, Pollard tells us about working with the real Brian Wilson and his wife, Melinda Ledbetter, on the film that tells their story. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Bill Pohlad, who directed and produced the Brian Wilson biopic, Love and Mercy, which focuses on two distinct periods in the musician's life, the 1960s and the 1980s. Paul Dano plays the younger Brian, a tormented musical genius, conducting a studio filled with musicians and animals while recording the album Pet Sounds.
Cut! I think we got it. Chuck, mix that in with the sound of the train going by at the end of the Caroline No. Hey, Chuck, you think we could get
20 years later, Wilson, as portrayed by Cusack, was still composing even as he was heavily medicated by his corrupt therapist. In Love and Mercy, Wilson's new girlfriend, Melinda, played by Elizabeth Banks, is impressed.
That's absolutely beautiful.
Thanks.
What is it?
Oh, that's just something that I came up when I saw you.
What are you going to do with it?
Nothing. It's gone.
Casting two actors who don't resemble each other to play the same person is a bold strategy for a biopic, especially given that the story is not told chronologically. The timelines are intricately interwoven. Pohlad says approaching the film this way just felt right.
Doing it with two different actors was more exciting. Certainly as we got into casting, there were those who suggested, you should go with one actor and age them up and age them down. It'd be a tour de force kind of thing for that actor.
Right.
But to me, it just didn't feel as exciting or as interesting. And so we went with the two-actor approach and then pushed it even further by not having Paul and John kind of coordinate their performances. The idea of just letting them find their own Brian, separately felt like, again, it was pushing the envelope and it was risky, but it would have paid off if it worked.
That is risky. Yeah. I'm sort of in awe of the riskiness. Did either one of them, who came first?
Paul Dano, for sure. Just because that Brian is a little more iconic. And when you start to look for actors in that age group, Paul was at the top of my list. It's like, this guy can do this. And it was exciting for a number of reasons with him. And there was, some similarity, or at least you could see, how he could go in that direction. The other Brian, we call him Brian Future, which is the one ended up playing by John Cusack, was a little more complicated in the sense that if you look at pictures of Brian during the 80s, he really does look like a lot of different people. Sometimes he's very thin and gaunt. Sometimes he's scraggly and very heavy, long hair and beard and all that. And so you look at all these photos, it's like, well, which physical thing are we going to go with for Brian? And I ended up rewatching a documentary about Brian that was made by Don Was called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. And, a shot of Brian came up early on of the real Brian, and it just struck me as John Cusack. It really connected with John in a real way. So people say he doesn't look like Brian, but he actually does at certain times in Brian's life. He looks very reminiscent of that era for me. Again, you're not doing it just on physical resemblance. Certainly that's not the idea of the movie. It is more to be more free and trying to get the essence of it. But it did connect with me.
So they did not, or did John Cusack meet with Brian? And
John did, yeah. Again, it was interesting just to go through the process of them finding their Brians. And because Paul, was like one of these things, the Brian of today is considerably different than the Brian from the 60s. So it didn't seem like it would be that productive for him to meet him. And Paul had a lot of other resources to draw on, the music being the primary source. And, the Brian of the 80s, there wasn't quite as much material. And he seemed also, that character seemed closer to the living Brian today. And so it did really work for John to spend time with Brian.
And Brian and his wife, Melinda, who's Elizabeth Banks, of course, in the movie, how did you work with them? Did you buy their rights or did they have consultation?
Brian and Melinda were kind of already associated with the project that came in, Heroes and Villains. And so when we got involved and kind of redirected it a bit, certainly I had to sit down with Brian and Melinda, get to know them a little bit and make sure that they were comfortable with the direction that I was going in. And so we got to know each other quite well and, things like the rights, certainly, yes, we bought their life rights. And certainly they had assistance. They helped us out on the music side, that we knew that we could have, there was a deal to be done. It wasn't a closed deal, but it was a deal, you know, we knew if we had them on our side, we'd be in good shape.
This was a licensing question.
Yes.
That can be mind-bendingly expensive to license music. Mm-hmm. So how did that work out?
Yeah, this is an independent film. They know the budget of the film, and, you know, you got to just convince people. I mean, first, it was not necessarily convincing Brian and Melinda, but, you know, making sure that they understood, because they, you know, would benefit on the music side as well. But they needed to understand that, you know, you're just not going to be able to make a movie at this budget level if we're paying full fare on the music. So you just try to work it out, and you work it out with the music companies and the publishers. But I can't say it was easy. In addition, you know, the other element we haven't talked about is Atticus Ross's sound kind of scape, and the idea that we had of trying to incorporate Brian's music into the movie in a lot of different ways.
Right, in terms of how he creates and also his mental illness.
Right. So that just, you know, using bits of Brian Wilson and Beach Boys music, you know, interwoven into the new score as well as into these soundscapes of mindscapes, you know, really made it complicated. It was like, you know, sampling, basically. So just trying to get all of that through the business side and the publishing and all that side, it was definitely a complicated exercise. But that's a normal process in filmmaking where, you know, either a budget or some other issue comes up that, you know, kind of forces you to, you know, find a different solution. And I think that's part of the dynamic and the good thing about making movies as well.
Yes, I mean, the creativity is not just stuff that is going to be seen on the screen sometimes.
Right.
So circling back to, you know, now you've got this, it's like the happy Hollywood ending. You've directed this movie and the movie really works and is lauded. Are you ready to just move on to the next directing project?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been working on that, well, since, you know, for a year or so since we started finishing up Love and Mercy. We've been working on a couple things. Oren Moverman and I are working on an adaptation of a novel, and it's a couple other things percolating. But in the meantime, I've also been producing Sean Penn's next directorial effort called The Last Face. So I have been, you know, stepping back to producing as well as wanting to go forward with directing.
I'm amazed at the sophistication, not to be, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but, you know, if it's your second time directing a film, it's an incredibly sophisticated piece of work.
Well, thank you.
I don't know quite how you got there from the snail movie or whatever they called it in the TV Guide, mean critic, but yeah. How did you move to such a sophisticated film? Do you know? You have any answer for that?
I mean, I don't. I know that whatever, like, I suppose anybody in this business or in the directing thing, you know, you got to have somewhat of an ego. You have to be able to believe that what you're doing is right and go for it. If you start questioning yourself and at all shy about it, it's going to just undermine the process. And I really, it is my philosophy that I like to do things that haven't been done before. And I just felt like I said, with Brokeback Mountain, you want to go for it. I might not have another chance to direct another movie. So if I'm going to do this one, I really want to go for it. So I don't know if that's courage or stupidity or whatever, but I just, you know, it really felt that way.
Bill Pollad is the director of Love and Mercy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.